The US versus John Lennon, a film by David Leaf and John Scheinfield. Interlocking cogwheels of different sizes spin and rotate. The camera pans out and through a keyhole. Doors open to reveal the word Lionsgate. A graphic reading, VH1, Rock Docs, is accompanied by a microphone. Then the logo for Authorized Pictures. December 10th, 1971, Ann Arbor, Michigan. A man addresses a huge crowd.
Jerry Rubin.
To all the people that say that the movement, the revolution is over, they ought to see what's going on right here, because it doesn't look over to me. This is like a dream, seeing 15,000 people in one place demanding freedom for John Sinclair.
I was sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in July of 1969 for giving two joints to an undercover policewoman.
All this time that John Sinclair has been in jail because of his opposition to the government, that government has dropped 2.5 Hiroshimas a week, every week, since July 1969 when John was in prison. And all that time, Richard Nixon was trumpeting, the war is winding down.
We had this concert, and it was broadcast all over the state. It was the biggest thing that ever happened in Michigan. Stevie Wonder, Bob Seger, Randy Davis, Jerry Rubin, Bobby Seale of the Black Panthers.
All power to the people. Thank you very much. Right on. Power to the people.
The stage was set to make a big impact if we could make this concert be huge. And then Jerry Rubin talked John Lennon and Yoko Ono into coming and playing on our concert.
Black and white photos of the bespectacled Lennon performing on stage.
We had no idea that there were FBI agents writing down the lyrics in the audience.
That's when the FBI began to see the beginning of the power of John and Yoko.
The power structure, especially during the Nixon administration, which began in 1968, was extremely paranoid about anyone who they perceived to be counterculture, counter-administration, anti-war, and of course John Lennon fell squarely in that arena.
When somebody in show business comes and participates in a political rally, he or she is doing something that is a very great personal sacrifice and even a personal risk.
Certainly, they feared what a figure like John Lennon represented.
Anybody who sings about love and harmony and life is dangerous to somebody who's singing about death and killing and subduing.
He was making friends with a lot of people that our government wanted to put in jail.
He was a high-profile figure, so his activities were being monitored.
A confidential FBI document.
And I think they wanted me to know, to scare me, and I was scared, paranoid.
He believed all of his telephone conversations were being monitored. He believed that he was being followed around New York City. He believed that friends that he thought were friends were secret informants for different intelligence communities.
We were just shocked, and we were really scared.
Another effect of the Sinclair thing was it probably further alerted the FBI, John Mitchell, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Nixon as to this threat to them, that something needed to be done to neutralize John Lennon.
The U.S. versus John Lennon. Graphics show official documents on which the name John Winston Lennon is prominent. The crosshairs of a gun sight is superimposed over images of President Richard Nixon and John Lennon. Black and white photos of John Lennon as a young boy, one with his mother. I Yoko Ono Lennon.
Childhood was something that he couldn't shake it. I mean, it was there all the time. And at night when we were in bed, he would be talking about it. His mother, especially his mother.
He was an orphan, really. He was abandoned by his father and, to all intents and purposes, abandoned by his mother. I mean, can you imagine being, growing up and realizing that neither your mother nor your father really wanted you? So it's no wonder he turned out a rebel.
Being born working class, it was a natural. I knew I was taught to hate and fear the police, hate and fear the establishment, and to fight it.
He had a chip on his shoulder for anybody who would tell him how to live his life and what to do and when to talk and when not to talk.
I was always in trouble. Every school I went to, I was thrown out. Everything I got involved in, I was always in trouble. So I was always against the wall.
Archive footage. A nighttime Ku Klux Klan parade with flaming torches and crosses. The Beatles disembark a plane. Protesters hold placards reading, "Go home, Beatles," "Jesus died for you, John Lennon," and "Ban the Beatles." The head of a John Lennon doll is set alight. Beatles records are smashed, photos torn up. August 1966.
This is Doug Layton and Tommy Charles. We're reminding you that our fantastic Beatle boycott is still in effect. We have not forgotten what the Beatles said.
The Beatles made a statement in all the newspapers that they're getting more better than Jesus himself.
Well, originally I was pointed out that fact in reference to England, that we meant more to kids than Jesus did, or religion at that time. I wasn't knocking it or putting it down, I was just saying it.
I think simply on the basis of statistics and fact, his statement is untrue. Well, no one is more popular than Jesus.
I just didn't mean what everybody thinks I meant, you know. I'm not anti-Christ or anti-religion or anti-God, you know.
So many people have built buildings in the name of Christ, and what have people done for the Beatles? What have they done for us?
I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said and it was wrong or was taken wrong and now it's all this.
We urge you to take your Beatle records, pictures and souvenirs to the pickup points about to be named, and on the night of the Beatles' appearance in Memphis, August 19th, they will be destroyed in a huge public bonfire at a place to be named soon. Nobody
told me that boxes of Beatles records are dumped onto a pile. Flaming torch is applied to the pile. A crowd watches as it catches fire. John Lennon speaks at a press conference.
It doesn't matter about people not liking our records or not liking the way they look or what we say. You know, they're entitled to not like us. We're entitled not to have anything to do with them if we don't want to, or not to regard them. You know, we've all got our rights, you know.
Clearly, Lennon already was thinking about, you know, this thing of being the lovable mop tops is not really their goal in life anymore. Lennon in particular is more willing to take on a critical stance, a rebellious stance. This, I think, is the beginning where Lennon sets out on the path that's going to bring him into direct conflict with the Nixon administration 6 years later.
Author of Gimme Some Truth, John Wiener.
The 60s did was show us the possibility and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility.
A U.S. Army building. With their right arms raised, a group of young men take an oath. July 28, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson.
We intend to convince the communists that we cannot be defeated by force of arms or by superior power. I have today ordered to Vietnam the Air Mobile Division and certain other forces which will raise our fighting strength from 75,000 to 125,000 men almost immediately.
Photos of Ron Kovich, author of Born on the 4th of July. He then speaks.
I joined the Marine Corps out of high school in September of 1964, and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. They could not have sent someone more dedicated. They could not have sent someone who was willing to follow their policy more than myself. While leading my squad across an open area, I was shot through the right shoulder. It went through my right lung, collapsed my lung, hit my spine, and severed my spinal cord, paralyzing me from my mid-chest down.
Injured American soldiers are assisted by colleagues in the Vietnam War. Governor of New York from 1983 to 1995, Mario Cuomo.
Vietnam was not an easily accepted war on the part of the population. It didn't have a 9/11 that we had. It didn't have a Pearl Harbor. It didn't have the motivating factors that would have encouraged a high degree of patriotism. And so it was an unpopular war and got to be more and more unpopular as it lingered and as people doubted more and more that it had any real purpose.
Some 2 million Vietnamese died in that conflict. That did not show life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness at its best.
Washington, D.C., October 1967.
The ferment was considerable, with a leading role played by young people throughout. People who were normally supposed to be apathetic and obedient and passive were actually entering the political arena to press their own demands and organizing to do something about it.
In this age of protests, one of the most recent finds 4,000 Londoners decrying British support for U.S. action in Vietnam. There were a few minor scuffles, but no arrests. The demonstrators were stopped from approaching Prime Minister Wilson's Downing Street home.
Journalist Tariq Ali.
The whole culture had become radicalized, and it's in this atmosphere that the Beatles were being forced to engage with the world.
Do you mind being asked questions? For example, in America, people keep asking you questions about Vietnam. Does this seem useful?
It seems a bit silly to be in America and for none of them to mention Vietnam as if nothing was happening.
But why should they ask you about it? You're successful entertainer.
That is why they, because Americans always ask showbiz people what they think about it. So do the British, you know. Showbiz, you know how it is. But, I mean, you've just got to. You can't just keep quiet about anything that's going on in the world unless you're a monk. Sorry, monks, I didn't mean it. I meant actually.
The thing you have to understand, which people don't understand necessarily about John, is that his thought processes were shifting. He was in a process of evolution.
Our society is run by insane people for insane objectives. If anybody can put on paper what our government and the American government, etc., and the Russian, Chinese, what they are actually trying to do, you know, and how, what they think they're doing, I'd be very pleased to know what they think they're doing. I think they're all insane. You know, but I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. You know, that's what's insane about it.
He was engaged with the world, and what was happening in the world would change him. And then, you know, something quite dramatic happened.
Black and white photos of Yoko Ono. Lennon Ono assistant from 1966 to 1972, Don Richter.
It's sort of hard to describe Yoko because she's completely unique. She had developed quite a good reputation as a conceptual artist. In fact, she used to call her stuff music of the mind.
In a performance art piece, Yoko Ono has her clothes snipped off by members of the public.
With my presentation of performance art, I was always aware that I wanted to inspire people and stir people so that they can wake up.
She once told me, like, if half the people don't get up and leave, I haven't done it right. You know, because she wanted to really affect people, and affecting people sometimes gets them very upset if they're not used to being aware of their feelings. She suddenly makes them feel something, they get angry, and they get angry at her for making them feel something.
I always had this dream of meeting an artist woman, you know, that I would fall in love with and all that, even from art school, you know. And then we met and we were talking and that, and then I don't know how it happened, you just realized that she knew everything I knew and more probably, and that it was coming out of a woman's head, you know. It just sort of bowled me over, you know.
I believe that when he met Yoko, he found the rest of his voice.
Longtime family friend, Elliot Mintz. Then John and Yoko kiss.
Yoko gave John this sense or belief that he could say and do anything he wanted to say and do without apology.
We crossed over into each other's fields, like people do from country to pop. We did it from avant-garde left field to rock and roll left field. And we tried to find a ground there that was interesting to both of us, and we both got excited and stimulated by each other's experiences.
We came from totally different backgrounds, but we were very, very similar in a sense that we're totally fiercely rebellious people.
John and Yoko give a press conference from inside a large white bag.
What are they doing? This Japanese witch has made him crazy and he's gone bananas. But what all she did was take the bananas part of me out of the closet more. It was a complete relief to meet somebody else who was as far out as I was. You know, that was the real thing.
Could you come out?
No.
Why not?
Because this is a bag event. Total communication.
Don't you think it's a little bit out of fashion what you do?
Do you think it's a fashion to stay in a bag?
What is it?
It's total communication.
What is total communication? An invention of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, or is it...
No, no, it exists, and we're showing you one example of whereby...
Total immersion.
Well, that's your version.
You know, if a black man goes for a job in a bag, if everybody had to go in a bag for a job, there'd be no prejudice, you see. You'd have to judge people on the quality within, you know, and we call it total communication. Yeah. When we went to Australia to show it, we did a press conference there in a bag, and it was great. Because all the press came in, you know, and they never saw us. We were just both in a bag, and they interviewed the bag, and they're saying, "Well, is it really you? And what are you wearing? And will you sing a song and that? And why us?" And they said, "What is this?" And I said, "It's total communication." I said, "But why did you pick on us? We've never seen a Beatle."
Protesters march. A placard reads, "We shall overcome." Another, "Black men should fight white racism, not Vietnamese freedom fighters." April 3rd, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
It was another kind of atmosphere. You have to imagine and understand that we, the Black Panther Party, we popped up right in the middle of an already ongoing nationwide protest movement.
Well, let me tell you something, brothers and sisters. If you wind up on a poverty gig and you don't save half that money to buy a gun a week, then you lagging, you jiving.
I think the Black Panther Party probably was dangerous, but not dangerous in the way that most people assume it might have been. Not dangerous because people had guns, but dangerous because of its ability to provide an example of the possibility of standing up to power.
Radical activist Dr. Angela Davis. Then photos and footage of a series of protest marches.
You have to be more politically aware in a day and age like this. It's almost impossible to close your eyes to it.
And they're afraid of us because we are not only a cultural and political threat, we are a military threat to those generals that are running that war and controlling young kids' minds over there. We're a military threat.
When it gets down to having to use violence, then you're playing the system's game. The establishment irritate you, pull your beard and flick your face to make you fight. Because once they've got you violent, then they know how to handle you.
The Democratic National Convention, Chicago, August 1968. As delegates gather in the convention hall, on the streets outside, protesters march linked arm in arm. Riot police wield batons. The National Guard wear gas masks and hold tear gas guns. Chanting protesters and police face off. A policeman drives his baton into the abdomen of a protester. Then, protesters are beaten with batons. U.S. Senator from 1963 to 1981, George Montgomery.
That Vietnam War divided this country as it had not been divided since the Civil War.
I was with several paralyzed veterans in a room at the Bronx Veterans Hospital on the paraplegic ward. And I remember we were watching the convention.
Mr. Chairman, most delegates to this convention do not know that thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago.
Riot police wade into fleeing protesters with their batons.
Perhaps John Lennon saw the clubs coming down on top of the heads of the peaceful demonstrators. Perhaps John Lennon heard the chants of "the whole world is watching, the whole world is watching." And perhaps John Lennon had tears streaming down his face that night, as I did too.
The Beatles performed the song Revolution.
I did note the transformation of the Beatles when their song Revolution came out. But when you talk about destruction,
don't you know that you can count me out? When I hear the song Revolution, even now, it just chokes me up. Because I remember that how hard it was for both of us at the time. We were both ostracized by the world and by the fans, too, that we were together. And also, John was daring to speak out.
Protest signs read, "Life is sacred, stop the war. Get the hell out of Vietnam and bring our GIs home now."
When John Lennon argued that revolution was necessary, but that it should come about through peaceful means, I don't think that he contradicted what many activists felt during that period. It's a mistake, I think, to assume that revolutions must be violent.
If I'm a revolutionary, or we are revolutionaries, we're revolutionary artists, not gunmen. I believe in the Black Panther original statement, the 10-point program, which is not violent, which says to defend yourself against attack, I might consider that, but anything else I don't consider. So I'm still for peace, peaceful revolutionary, but I'm an artist first and a politician second.
He always believed we had to go about it in a way that Gandhi did, for instance. It was very effective, he felt, you know, and we could do it that way.
Stay in bed.
Enjoy your hair.
Bed peace.
Hairpiece.
Hairpiece, bedpiece. Oh, yeah.
March 1969. Photos and footage of John and Yoko's wedding. Photographer and friend Bob Groom.
They were actually trying to come up with an idea to have a honeymoon, like most people, a secret romantic place to go to, and but realizing that they were part of the world media and that wherever they went, the media would want to go.
We're going to stay in bed for 7 days, sort of, instead of having a private honeymoon. It's a private protest.
For the violence that's going in the world, you see.
To say,
we feel that instead of making war, it's better to just stay in bed. Let's stay in bed for 3 days.
And grow your hair.
Yes.
For peace. Let it grow till peace comes, you know.
What the press really wants is a picture of John and Yoko in bed on their honeymoon. And then they turned it around and said, well, in that case, let them have a picture of John and Yoko in bed on their honeymoon, but put the word peace in it.
So, yeah, I thought we're going to make love in bed. You see, and all the press from all around the world came, and we opened the, our helpers opened the door, and they fighting to get in, the, you know, like this with the cameras. And then their faces dropped, and we're sitting like angels saying, hello, peace, brother. And all their faces dropped, and we were just in bed. And
you were
we
wearing,
thought
the,
it, We thought it was a great practical joke that most of the world's headline newspapers, especially the European and British, was married couple are in bed.
Oh, there had never been anything like it. It was completely original. The conscious use of one's myth to project a political and social poetic goal. It had never happened before.
Up to then, people who were promoting world peace were kind of like intellectual, anemic kind of people, just sort of like passing on pamphlets that nobody wants to read, you know? And so John was saying, no, that's why we wanted to do it this way, you know? And I think we did a great job.
At a press conference, John opens a letter.
Please stop this this nonsense. Go home. We don't like people like you. Go to a doctor to be normal. Are you getting this?
It's great.
Hey, go to a doctor to be normal. Well, we're seeing a psychiatrist today, so maybe he'll fix us up. Bloody marvellous.
When people are creative geniuses, you have to cut them some slack. You really have to cut them some slack. England isn't good at cutting slack for working-class boys.
If it works, it's right. Yeah. If it doesn't work, it's wrong.
Well, nobody's ever given it a chance before, have they? Nobody's ever given peace a complete chance. Gandhi tried it, Martin Luther King tried it, but they were shot. But nobody's given...
You can't get peace in a king-size divan on floor 802.
We don't expect to, but I mean, we're talking mainly to the revolutionaries who think they can get it overnight by breaking down the buildings, you know. They can't get it. We thought about this for months. This is the best possible, most functional and effective way of promoting and protesting against violence that our minds combined could think of.
That someone of his caliber had decided, hell, I'm not just going to stand still and do nothing while the world around me is in flames. I'm going to do something. And so that action that he and Yoko did, it was, of course, attacked and mocked, and there were contemptuous articles written about them. But on our generation, it had a fantastic effect. I remember being absolutely thrilled and saying, at last, well done, great.
We didn't think of it as we made an incredible success in Amsterdam. We were totally accused of doing a silly thing, as you know. In the press, they attacked us and they slashed us, you know. But this was our mission and we had to do it.
May 1969. John and Yoko walk across tarmac to a waiting plane.
We did it again. We tried to do it in New York, but the American government wouldn't let us in. They knew we'd done it in Amsterdam, and they didn't want any peaceniks here, which is what we heard the department of whoever controls that said. But we ended up doing it in Montreal instead and broadcasting across the border.
In white pajamas, John scrambles onto a double bed.
It's a bed in, folks. I think they might think I'm going to hot up the revolution, you know. I want to cool it down. If we make people laugh, that's enough. Happiness is a good vibe for peace.
Make love, not war, that's all we're saying. Just remember that.
Peace, 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 peace.
Peace in your mind, peace on earth, peace at work, peace at home, peace in the world.
We're selling it like soap, you know. And you've got to sell and sell until the housewife thinks, well, there's peace or war, that's the two products.
I remember being invited up to the Bed In for Peace. The Smothers Brothers were fairly visible at the time as an anti-establishment spokesman. I went up there and had these long conversations.
You don't realize the state and the control that exists in the United States in the expression of what you want to say, to the mildest form of dissent.
There's no space or no time for negative thoughts, you know. We just have to say, listen, we're going to make it, that's all, you know. And we have to make it.
What would you say to people like Richard Nixon?
I'd say do something positive about it, and it really is economical to have peace, Mr. Nixon, and you'd be really popular if you did.
What should he do?
He should just declare peace.
He reduced it to these very fundamental, easy-to-grasp concepts that some people thought were utopian and naive.
I believe sincerely, as soon as people want peace and they're aware that they can have it, they will have it. The only trouble is they're not aware that they can get it.
Is it naive to wish for peace? Is it naive to think that we can change the world? Sure, probably. It's certainly worthy of the thought process and the art that comes out of it.
One, two, three, four!
John once said to me, when I sing, I want to hold your hand. Hundreds of millions of people hear that. Why don't I sing, Give Peace a Chance? Because hundreds of millions of people would hear that as well.
I thought that was a great phrase. That's the one that went, all we are saying is give peace a chance. They'd repeat that over and over again. I thought it was wonderful. Give peace a chance. Who can be opposed to that? The administration was.
They scare people into fighting wars, which we need not fight, should not fight, sometimes must fight, but by and large not. Why not go the other way? Sing about human community, sing about love, sing about peace. And suddenly that is a frightening voice for people who want to hear the battle hymn of the Republic over and over again. And their eyes have seen the coming of the glory of the Lord.
Author, historian, Gore Vidal. John and Yoko make peace signs as they pose for the camera. Then they smile at each other and kiss.
The highlight of the bedding for me was the fact that after all the reporters left, and it was a beautiful moon that was like a full moon, and from our bed we can see this beautiful full moon and not one cloud there, so the beautiful sky. And John was saying, you know, isn't this great and all that, and he was saying that, you know, are we just going to go on communicating the world together, and our song is going to be played all over the world, and you know, that's how it's going to be. And he was very, very happy about that, about the fact that we are promoting world peace and love, and we have both.
They smile as they lie next to each other in bed. As Yoko nestles against his shoulder, John playfully pulls her hair down over her face. He then wraps his arms around her and closes his eyes.
It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give and take negotiations or terrible escalation. And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North, the use of nuclear weapons, or the mere commitment of 100 or 200 or 300,000 more American troops to the battle. And with each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster.
You see, the war was such a great mistake. We went into Vietnam in order to preserve a democracy which did not exist. The fact of the matter was, South Vietnam was a monarchy and a rather cruel one. We were fighting for an already lost cause before we ever put the first foot into the country.
Never has so much power been used so ineffectively as in Vietnam. If after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, Then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership, not tied to the policies and mistakes of the past. I pledge to you, we shall have an honorable end to the war in Vietnam.
Well, he did run with the promise that he had a secret plan that he was going to unveil after the election to end the war.
The war was enough to drive you crazy. People were being drafted. 50,000 American soldiers were killed. 50,000.
40% of all the young Americans who died in Vietnam died during those 4 years after Nixon was elected in 1968.
Vietnam combat footage. A gun is pointed to a woman's head. Blindfolded prisoners, including children, are guarded by armed U.S. soldiers. November 3, 1969, President Richard M. Nixon.
We have adopted a plan, which we have worked out in cooperation with the South Vietnamese, for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. As South Vietnamese forces become stronger, the rate of American withdrawal can become greater. I have not and do not intend to announce the timetable for our program.
November 15, 1969.
We meet today to reaffirm those ageless values that gave us birth, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we meet to declare peace, to put an end to war, not in some distant future, but to put an end to it now.
I like to be liked. I don't like to say things that everybody doesn't agree with. When peace marchers come to Washington, it would be very easy to say, I agree with them. I will do what they want. But a president has to do what he considers to be right, because I believe that sometimes it is necessary to draw the line clearly, not to have enmity against those who disagree, but to make it clear that there can be no compromise where such great issues as self-determination and freedom and a just peace are involved.
I recall approaching the Treasury building one evening, and there were just streams of them coming down the street, and they all had candles, some sort of symbolism that they were using. And back in those days, I smoked cigars, and I recall just walking up to one of them, grabbing his wrist, and taking the candle and lighting my cigar with it. And I looked him in the eye and said, there, you're useful for some purpose, and then went on by. That was our attitude toward them.
Nixon would put out the line during these demonstrations that he was watching a football game or something like that. He was very concerned with the demonstrations. They were making a definite impact inside the White House.
White House Counsel John Dean. Then footage from a huge peace rally.
Are you listening, Nixon?
All we are saying.
Are you listening, Agnew?
Give peace a chance.
Are you listening in the Pentagon?
All we are saying.
Well, give peace a chance. You know, I remember photographing a million people at an anti-war demonstration, singing it with their hands up. And that song became the national anthem of the anti-war movement in a way that, like the folk song We Shall Overcome, became the national anthem of the civil rights movement before that.
Sing it out!
All we are saying.
War is over, if you want it. Peace.
Posters in a variety of locations bear the message, war is over, if you want it. Happy Christmas from John and Yoko. John and Yoko hold one of the War is Over posters.
With War is Over If You Want It, I said, okay, let's do posters. And then John said, no, let's do billboards as well in all different cities in the world. Wow. I mean, he was like that because his arena of communication was much larger than mine. So he thought of that.
It's in 11 cities throughout the world. That's New York, LA, Montreal, Toronto, Paris, Berlin, Rome, London, Athens, and Tokyo. And with a bit of luck, Port of Spain in the Caribbean, because we met a friend there who said he'd fix it, you know.
Where is the money coming from for the posters you've got now?
It's coming out of our pocket at the moment, but we've had a few offers to help, you know. But people said, how much is it? I don't know, but it's cheaper than somebody's life.
I mean, he was using the fact that the media had an obsessive affair with him. Whatever he did, they had to pay attention. But that doesn't actually mean that you got a coherent idea of what they were trying to say, because obviously the media didn't really understand it, and to the extent they understand it, they didn't like it.
I'm someone who admired you very much.
Well, I'm sorry you liked the old mop tops, dear, and you thought it was I was very satirical and witty, and you liked Hard Day's Night, love, but I've grown up, but you obviously haven't.
Have you?
Yes, folks.
What have you grown up to?
Now 29.
John was no dummy. He knew that people would regard him as being a nutcase. Right? He didn't care. He thought that whatever people thought about him was unimportant compared to the cause he was promoting.
If I'm going to get on the front page, I might as well get on the front page with the word peace.
But you've made yourself ridiculous.
To some people, I don't care.
If it saves lives... You don't think you... Oh, my dear boy, you're living in another nether.
Well, you talk to...
You don't think you saved a single life.
Will you tell me, what were they singing at the moratorium?
Which, I mean, the moratorium, the
recent big one, they were singing Give Peace a Chance, you know.
A song of yours, probably.
Well, yes, and it was written specifically for them.
So they sang one of your songs.
Well, if you...
Great song, sure, but is that all you can say about that, the moratorium?
You were saying that in America they're so serious about the protest movement.
Yes, they are.
But they were so flippant that they were singing a happy-go-lucky song, which happens to be one I wrote, and I'm glad they sang it, and when I get there I'll sing it with them.
Viewed from above, thick jungle bisected by a straight ribbon of river. Explosions rip through the dense forest in huge orange fireballs as bombs hit the ground. Activist Noam Chomsky.
April 1970, Nixon invaded Cambodia, and at that point the country practically blew up.
Protesters rhythmically punch the air and chant as they face off with armed National Guard. Clouds of tear gas drift towards fleeing protesters as guardsmen advance slowly across a lawn.
Four students on May 4th, 1970 were killed by National Guardsmen at Kent State University for protesting. They were protesting against the war.
Okay, you had 18-year-old college kids without the sense God gave a goose going around challenging 18-year-old kids with 30-06 semi-automatic rifles. Yes, they were in uniform, but they were National Guard, very little training. They felt threatened, they were armed. What did you think was gonna happen?
In a photo, the body of a young man lies face down on the ground as a weeping woman kneels next to him. More photographs. A blindfolded Vietnamese boy's mouth gapes in a scream. Then a wounded US soldier is helped to walk by two colleagues. A young soldier plays an acoustic guitar. On his helmet is scrawled the words, "Oklahoma Kid." A Vietnamese man has his brains blown out by a gun held just inches from his temple by a fellow countryman. A young Vietnamese boy in army fatigues holds a rifle. Anti-war marchers under a banner reading, "Active Duty GIs." A middle-aged woman holds a sign reading, "Protest is patriotic."
I hope someday
John finishes the song and looks towards Yoko, who is sitting next to him at the piano. As she gazes at him, he shrugs his shoulders. Immediately, she smiles, and they kiss.
Somehow I thought that this was an irresistible tide that was going to carry the whole of America with it, and we didn't quite see the backlash that was actually already brewing and quite evident if you were just willing to open your eyes.
Each of the special agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation must be ready and capable to meet any challenge. The security of our nation or the life of a loved one may depend upon him.
Hoover was a man who had a slightly different version of democracy than the rest of us did.
The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, as documents now make clear, I don't think there's any real debate about it anymore, used the FBI as an instrument almost as a political police force. Anyone who was off message became susceptible to an FBI probe.
They say sometimes that Mr. Hoover is controversial. Let me tell you something. Anybody who's strong, anybody who fights for what he believes in, anybody who stands up when it's tough is bound to be controversial.
Back in those days, the FBI would operate affirmatively. In other words, not just gather intelligence, but it perceived as its mission the disruption of the other side.
Anyone who was involved at that time in any movement that challenged the government in any way was aware of the extent to which the FBI tapped people's phones, engaged in widespread surveillance, engaged in harassment, framed people up, used the legal system.
Ours is a just cause. If we have faith in humanity, if we seek God's divine guidance, if we summon the courage of our forefathers, our heritage of freedom will be preserved.
Yeah, looking back, it was horrible what we did. We were being used by the government to stop dissent, just plain and simple.
And it was very serious. I mean, it reached as far as political assassination, Gestapo-style assassination of a leading black organizer in Chicago, Fred Hampton.
A newspaper headline reads, "Police in Chicago slay two Panthers."
It was what Hoover liked. It was what Hoover wanted to hear, that agents were neutralizing these different organizations. So there wasn't a question of whether it was right or wrong, legal, ethical, immoral, or whatever, as long as it was effective.
America has no place for those timid souls who urge appeasement at any price, nor those who chant the better red than dead slogan. We need men and women with a capacity for moral indignation, men and women of faith, men and women of conviction, men and women with the God-given strength and determination to uphold the cause of democracy.
September 1971, John and Yoko give a clenched fist salute to the Statue of Liberty. Then they happily dance arm in arm in a park.
When we went to New York, we were so elated. John was in love with New York City to begin with, and I, for me, of course, it was almost like my hometown. And we met all the artists and all the sort of underground politicians and everything. It was just so exciting. So we started to feel that we should stay.
More footage of them in New York, both wearing black berets and sunglasses. John also sports a green military-style shirt with sergeant stripes on the shoulder.
I just sort of felt at home here. As soon as I relaxed and got over the fact that I wasn't, you know, in England and that I was living somewhere else, I just, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, they speak English, so I just fitted in.
At that point, I think John said it felt like, you know, the center of the creative world, and that in the time of Rome, you'd want to be in Rome. You wouldn't want to be in the suburbs. And in the time of the 70s, you'd want to be in New York.
John wanted to live right here. He didn't want any hassles, but he came into a cauldron. He put himself right in the middle of a political firestorm, and he got singed by it.
The problem with John Lennon was not his music, but it was with some of the friends that he began to develop.
activist Jerry Rubin.
They may consider the Chinese, they may consider the Vietnamese, they may consider the Viet Cong their enemies, but they're my brothers, not the enemies. You see? Dig it.
We are at war with that empire that pollutes and tries to destroy the world and its own young people. We are at war, Nixon. Remember that.
Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin were very highly evolved political activists. They, I hasten to add, had a sweetness to them too, but they were much more hardened by the wars that they had been fighting now for several years in a very public environment.
We met them and we were both very nervous about it. And I thought, I don't, you know, I want to be careful. I don't want to be any bomb-throwing freaks and all that jazz, you know. And we finally met and we were very nervous. And we were both pleasantly surprised by how they both were not at all like their image, as we aren't like our image. And many other people I've met, who I believe the newspaper image about them, although I should know better because I've seen a lot of rubbish written about myself that isn't true. Mm. So we met, we found something in them that was artistic. And the first thing we said to them is, hey,
yes.
You're like artists, man. You're writing these books, you're performing theatre, you're like artists. And they said, well, you two artists are more like revolutionaries to us.
When they met Hoffman and Rubin, they were absolutely instruments in the hands of two political masters. When John and Yoko came, you know, da-da-da-da, give peace a chance, they went, da-da-am, now I have another weapon to use against the state.
The knife lying on a table is not a threat to anybody. It requires human responsible agency to take the knife and use it to cut somebody's throat. He would be looked upon as a tool. In this instance, he was being manipulated in a way that harmed the effort of the United States to win the war in Vietnam and to have order and stability here at home.
Yoko and I were lucky enough to meet this man a few weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, and we found he was a beautiful guy, and he had a lot to say. He was doing a lot that was not what I'd read in the paper about it. We came straight from England. Mm. There was a lot of these things like the foundation giving food to people, the programs of education, and we thought, well, let's see that side of these people. And the man we're going to introduce is a good friend of ours, and also of yours, I hope. The man is Bobby Seale, the chairman of the Black Panther Party, and here he is.
What Bobby Seale added to this equation was a far more dangerous aspect, a far more immediate physical kind of threat. He was much more foreboding and menacing than the other guys.
We can speak of pollution in terms of the historical pollution of fascism, the historical pollution of war, the historical pollution of hunger in the world, the historical pollution of murder, the historical pollution that we people, poor oppressed people in this world all over, have been subjected to for too many years. That pollution is the basis of the pollution of the nature, the world, the universe. The only solution to pollution is a people's humane revolution.
Both John and I felt that he was a very, very intelligent guy. And we communicated on that level.
This is one of those personalized kind of coalitions. You know, and he was telling me up front, he says, I want to help, I want to get some money and donate and do whatever we can to help the cause. Because what you're doing, he saw what we were about, you know, through me rapping with him and talking to him, telling him those stories and stuff and all the things we did.
What is the policy of the Black Panther Party? Because a lot of people don't know.
Policy, maybe you might be talking
about
philosophy.
Well, maybe that's the wrong word. Yeah. Philosophy,
well, philosophy is basically what we call intercommunalism. We're not nationalists.
Right.
We don't believe in nationalism. Nationalism, or nationhood, you know, always hooked up, is akin to superiority, is akin to racism, is akin to
that's
sectarianism.
That's what I said in my song.
So we're not
no
that.
Countries.
So
I guess at that point we'd evolved to really be friends, you know what I mean? We liked each other. I liked John, you know? This guy was defending something that I thought was necessary and relevant about those protest movement times.
You know, when you put Bobby Seale on the team, that every cop's gonna hate you, that every law enforcement person on earth is gonna oppose you and characterize everything you do in the context of a true enemy of the state.
He could have stayed in music, stayed away from drugs, kept his mouth shut about what he liked or disliked about the United States. Don't get involved in any politics. Just sing your songs and keep quiet. Everything would have been fine. But now when he starts financing the people that we're trying to put in jail, then that gets kind of serious.
I mean, the notion that the world's largest, most powerful imperial nation, the United States of America, could be seriously threatened by a writer, an intellectual, a singer, a painter, is laughable. I mean, it's just a joke. But it indicates at how nervous they were.
The authorities were terrified of him because he just had so much sway. Terrified. See, they weren't frightened of people like Mick Jagger. That was just musicians and silly long-haired gits misbehaving, too much money. Trouble with John is there was some intellectual force behind the argument.
Anyone who didn't like this country could either shut up or leave. And that was the way I think all of us felt.
Well, that's what they would say. What is this foreigner doing over here with his dirty songs, criticizing us and our war? Patriotism is, as we know, the last refuge of the scoundrel. Now we're talking about real scoundrels like Nixon. And some present-day people do play the same number. Oh, it's unpatriotic, unpatriotic.
A poster advertising the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, topping the bill, John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
John Lennon, Yoko Ono!
December 10th, 1971.
We came here not only to help John and to spotlight what's going on, but also to show and to say to all of you that apathy isn't it, and that we can do something. Okay, so flower power didn't work, so what? We start again. This song I wrote for John Sinclair.
John Sinclair.
I became a cultural activist, community activist in Detroit 40 years ago. We wanted to say that they should end the war and that people should love each other. So then we started proselytizing for marijuana legalization. While smoking great quantities, which was not really the wisest, you know, decision. You should kind of do one or the other, you know, if you want to be successful at either. I kept getting arrested for marijuana possession and then for giving two joints to an undercover policewoman.
He's been jailed 2.5 years for smoking two joints. There's such a thing as the solidarity of saliva. And when one pot smoker is in jail, every one of us is in jail.
I was sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in July of 1969 and sent to prison and kept under maximum security and was actually declared a threat to the society by the Michigan Court of Appeals.
Okay, Johnson's there, nice and easy now. Sneaky. Wrong. Wrong.
It ain't fair, John Sinclair, in the step of breathing air. Won't you care for John Sinclair, in the step of breathing air? Let him be, set him free, let him be like you and me. I gave him 10 for 2. Number 2. We got to set him.
It was a 12-hour concert. It was broadcast live all over the state. The day before that concert, John Sinclair was denied appeal bond. The Michigan Supreme Court wouldn't let him out.
If he was a soldier man, shooting gooks in Vietnam. If he was the CIA, selling dope and making hay. He'd be free, they'd let him be, breathing air like you and me. They gave him 10 for 2. What else can Judge Columba do? We got to set him free.
And man, everything just skyrocketed. And the tide of public opinion turned in my favor almost 180 degrees because the regular people thought, geez, this guy from the Beatles is coming to see about this guy's case. There must be something wrong with it.
on Monday morning, the Michigan Supreme Court reversed itself and let Sinclair out. Let him free.
A barred prison gate slides open, allowing John Sinclair to walk into the embrace of a waiting woman and child. Musician and friend, David Peel.
That's when the FBI began to see the beginning of the power of John and Yoko, especially John Lennon.
We are certifying the 26th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. That amendment, as you know, provides for the right to vote of all of our young people between 18 and 21, 11 million new voters as a result of this amendment that you now will see certified by the GSA administrator.
So Nixon now is facing a huge electorate that he has never faced before, this 18 to 21-year-old demographic, the heart and soul of John's fans. So there was a fear that John could stir, that John could affect, that John could imperil the political existence of Richard Nixon.
Well, I suppose if you want to kind of list your enemies and decide who is most dangerous, if I were Nixon, I would put Lennon up near the top.
A few years ago, you would have said, let's not vote. Voting's irrelevant. Yeah. And I had that feeling, too, and I never did vote in my life. But now I met you and a lot of people, and you're all saying register to vote. That doesn't seem like very radical to me. So what's the change in from 2 years ago? You would say don't vote, and now you say vote.
This time, since there's an 18-year-old vote, and it ought to be reduced to 12, we think that all young people should vote as a block, and we shouldn't vote for any candidate that doesn't automatically withdraw everything from Vietnam, and we ought to go to both conventions in Miami and San Diego and nonviolently make our presence felt and stand on the issues.
They were so heady from the success of getting Sinclair out of jail from that concert that there were quite a few meetings, as I recall, in New York where they were really planning a tour, quite a large tour.
We talked about, you know, how could we stage a tour basically that would follow Richard Nixon around America during the presidential campaign of 1972.
Our job now is to tell them that there is still hope and we still have things to do and we must get out there and change their heads and tell them it's okay, we can change it. It isn't over just because flower power didn't work. It's only the beginning. We're just in the inception of revolution. We're just the beginning of change. And they're all apathetic because they're young and they think, oh, it didn't work today, so it's all over. We must get them excited about what we can do again. And that's why we're going to go on the road.
And we were going to end up with a free 3-day rock festival outside the Republican National Convention.
From America, it'll spread to the rest of the world. Vive la revolution.
It was our perspective of Lennon that most of the time he was walking around stone, whacked out of his mind. But he was a high-profile figure. And so his activities were being monitored.
They knew for a fact that they didn't want hundreds, thousands, millions of young people attending a counter-convention, especially where John Lennon would perform.
I don't think he realized the strength of the American political establishment and how much power it could exert onto him with regard to silencing him, or covert ways in which they might follow his activities.
We were sure that the phones were all tapped, and it was, like most things, our wildest dreams did not begin to touch what they were actually doing against us.
Do you think that they are kind of picking on you, John?
Oh, yeah, they picked on me. I'm telling you, when it first started, I was followed in a car, and my phone was tapped, and I think they wanted me to know to scare me, and I was scared, paranoid. Mm. And people thought I was crazy then, you know. I mean, they do anyway, but I mean, more so, you know, Lennon. Oh, you big-headed maniac, right? Who's going to follow you around? Well, what do they want? You know, that's what I'm saying. What do they want? You know, I'm not going to cause them any problem.
It surprised me when I heard that Lennon had been under surveillance, that he'd been wiretapped, just as it did when I heard that Martin Luther King had been. These sort of things that came out of the FBI really caught me as being so unnecessary and so risky, and why?
I can't prove it, you know. I just know there's a lot of repairs going on in the cellar. I know the difference between the phone being normal when I pick it up and when every time I pick it up there's a lot of noises, you know. And I'd open the door and there'd be guys standing on the other side of the street. I'd get in a car and they'd be following me in a car and not hiding, you see. That's why I got a bit paranoid as well. They wanted me to see I was being followed, you know. Suddenly I realized this was serious, you know. They were coming for me one way or the other, you know. I mean, they were harassing me.
I remember John said to me at one point, if anything happens to Yoko and me, it was not an accident.
When we found out that they were specifically interested in stopping our plans, that's when we realized that it wasn't just the usual surveillance, but that they were going to take aggressive steps against us.
Well, this story begins, at least from the White House perspective, with a letter that Senator Strom Thurmond wrote.
The Congress is long overdue in investigating the radical left for the purpose of devising new legislation to protect the security of our nation from enemy subversive efforts.
He was a major figure on the right, as the right became much more of a dominant force in our politics in this country in the 70s.
Strom Thurmond was a Republican senator on the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, and he had been given the information about the plans that Lennon was making with Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, and other people for this national concert tour. This is what Strom Thurmond wrote the White House about. And this is where Strom Thurmond came up with a proposal to stop this. Strom Thurmond's memo to the White House ends, if Lennon's visa were terminated, it would be a strategic countermeasure.
One day, somebody knocked at the door, and we didn't open the door. We said, who is it? Who is it? Immigration. And the person just slipped the paper underneath the door. Because we didn't open the door, maybe that's why. And we looked at it, and it was a notice, a deportation notice. And we just looked at each other. What are we going to do? And it was a very frightening moment.
Extracts from the deportation notice. Your temporary stay in the United States as visitors has expired on February 29, 1972. It is expected you will effect your departure on or before March 15, 1972. Failure to do so will result in the institution of deportation proceedings. March 16, 1972. Both dressed in suits and ties, John and Yoko arrive at the offices of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. A posse of reporters and photographers converge on them.
Can't see no future. Can't see no sky.
Well, John, what did you say? You said you felt it was shocking?
Well, yeah, we're a bit shocked, you know.
Do you think that you will be deported?
I have no idea. Maybe it's just a process. I don't know.
We better go in. We're late, you know. We'll see you when we come out, if you want.
Can we talk to you when you come out?
We have a number of matters that we have to take care of.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service was planning to stage a huge show trial and basically get John Lennon in a very, very public way. They were going to try and show that he was an undesirable alien because of his lifestyle, because of his friends, and because of his politics. And then they were going to take some of the lyrics from some of his songs and play them. And a lot of his songs were very antagonistic to the Nixon administration.
What are your proceedings make you feel just on a purely emotional level?
Well, I feel like I'm back in school again. You know, I've been in trouble all my life, one way or the other, and I'm glad to see the head, you know, and this time they don't cane me, that's all. They don't beat me anymore.
Well, there are two reasons the trial didn't happen. One is that the investigator, who was the only sober-thinking person in all of this, felt that it was going to alienate all the youth in America if they did it. And secondly, it was a big waste of time and money because they already had the ability to get Lennon thrown out of the country.
In the late 60s, there was a head-hunting cop who was not very high up in the drug department in London, which was pretty new anyway. They had two dogs for the whole department. And he went round and bust every pop star he could get his hands on, and he got famous. And some of the pop stars had dope in the house, and some of them didn't. It didn't matter to him. He planted it or did whatever. Later on, that's what he did to me, because at that time I didn't have any drugs.
We had no idea that it would come back to haunt us in a very big way, too.
I was convicted of possession in England and fined $100. I mean, £100.
Is this an obstacle?
I was told to plead guilty rather than get into trouble.
Is that the obstacle to your staying here?
Yeah.
His problem seems to be the marijuana conviction. And while that stands, there's no form of relief that's possible in his case.
If he had 4 speeding tickets, or if he had, you know, I make up all the offenses he could have done were he an American citizen, they would have tried to find a way, his vulnerable spot, his Achilles heel. And that's what that was. All it was it gave John Mitchell and that crowd an opening through which to attack him.
John, why are you being deported?
Well, the sort of official reason is something about that I was bussed in England for pot. And the real reason is because I'm a peacenik.
You don't think there's any possibility that the government is trying to harass the Lennons?
Absolutely not. This is the kind of treatment we would dish out to anybody convicted of a narcotics offense.
A lawyer's name is Leon Wilds, and he's not a radical lawyer, he's not a William Consul, nothing like that. We went to an immigration lawyer who knew about immigration, and he has really been surprised, because he worked in immigration 15 years, he's really been surprised by some of the things that have gone on.
I took the case because it was a challenge. First of all, because I was impressed with these extraordinary people. And second, because these were issues which had never been previously ruled on in their present form in American courts.
You say you've been in trouble all your life. Why is that?
I'm just one of those faces, you know. People never like my face.
Oh, is that why?
Teachers used to get furious about it.
Is it because you're anti-establishment?
I guess it must show on the face, you know.
My original comment to them about the case was that I thought it was a loser. Why? Because most of my clients end up in a deportation proceeding, and if they lose, that's the end of it. If they appeal that decision, they go to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and that is hardly ever successful.
With Leon, he was always kind of suggesting, hopelessly, that maybe you guys should be a little bit gentler or something.
We announced the birth of a conceptual country, Newtopia. Citizenship of the country can be obtained by declaration of your awareness of Newtopia. Newtopia has no land, no boundaries, no passports, only people. Newtopia has no laws other than cosmic. All people of Newtopia are ambassadors of the country. As 2 ambassadors of Newtopia, we ask for diplomatic immunity and recognition in the United Nations for our country and its people. Newtopian Embassy, 1 White Street, New York, New York.
Yoko apologized to me afterwards and said, you have to understand, when you represent artists, we're not always predictable. I said, maybe not always predictable, but always enjoyable.
What does the flag mean? What does the flag mean?
Surrender and submission.
It became clear to me that he was a guy of major principle. And he understood that what was being done to him was wrong. It was an abuse of the law. And he was willing to stand up and try to show it, to shine the big light on it.
They're even sort of changing their own rules to get us, you know, just because we're peacenicks, really.
Yeah. Do you think it's because of your anti-war action and not your marijuana conviction, Ed?
Well, I mean, let's say that a few friends of ours in the pop business have exactly the same conviction as me and are allowed to come and go as free as they like. They just don't happen to have the same point of view as me, or they don't state it.
Will you now stop speaking out against the war because of
this? No, nothing will stop me, and whether I'm here or wherever I may be, I'll always have the same feelings and say what I feel, you know?
We loved him for who he was and who he was to become during that period. And he marched with us, he walked with us, he went up against this powerful government that was terribly wrong, that had misled us into a deeply immoral war. He did not back down.
It's great that you came in the rain. And I read somewhere that the war movement was over. We're here to bring the boys home. But let's not forget the machines. Bring the machines home, and then we really get somewhere. The people are the only people that can do it.
It wasn't so much that Lenin was being critical of U.S. policy. It's that he was over here enjoying all the benefits of the success that we were giving him, the wealth, and all the rest of it, and bad-mouthing us here. Our attitude was, you want to do that? Go back to London, go back to Liverpool.
I like to be here because this is where the music came from. This is what influenced my whole life and got me where I am today, as it were. And I love the place. I'd like to be here. I've got a lot of friends here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I want to be, you know. Statue of Liberty, welcome. I even brought my own cash.
He was under an order to leave the country within 60 days for pretty much all of 1972 and on into 1973.
Our reaction to the government's action taken last week, I believe, has been very, very succinctly put by the Wall Street Journal in an editorial of March 28, 1973. It states, "We find it more than a little hard to believe that authorities could find no legal way to resolve what is, after all, a highly unusual set of circumstances. Further, we submit, if the law does not reflect the human equities, it is a law that needs to be changed."
Yes, the case was very difficult at that point, and what he did was to just keep on extending our stay, which I thought was very wise, a very wise tactic.
I don't understand law, as it were, because it is finite, you know, and I don't really go, sort of, I can't express it and dig that scene, you know. I don't know, you know, it seems just like me, as somebody once said, Kafkaesque. It's just bureaucracy, and they get going, and then what can they do, you know? They don't know where to turn, I suppose. The game started, and we have to play it out.
When I talked to Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman about this period, they told me they wanted to try something new, something they thought would maybe be more effective in stopping the war. Jerry Rubin was talking about what he called a political Woodstock that they would hold outside the Republican National Convention.
They really tried to make us go to Miami. And we kept saying we're not going to do it. But Jerry, for political reasons, just announced that we're going to be there.
They think we're going to San Diego or Miami, whatever it is. We've never said we're going. We ain't going. There'll be no big jam with us and Dylan because there's too much going on. We never said we were going. That's it.
By then, John and I realized that it would have been very, very dangerous for us. We had a very distinct, clear feeling that if we had gone to the Republican convention, we would have been in danger of our lives.
Next, a series of black and white photos of John.
How can I go forward when I don't know which way I'm facing? How can I go forward when I don't know which way to turn?
Radical activist Stu Albert.
You know, he said, the only thing I ever really wanted to do in my life was to play in a rock and roll band. And then he said, I can't let them take that away from me. The very core of his existence was threatened by what they were trying to do to him.
Television graphic shows the Stars and Stripes flag accompanied by the title Decision 72.
It is now clear that Richard Nixon is the winner of this election. That's what our trend now indicates. The president reelected by a landslide.
November 7th, 1972. President Richard Nixon is congratulated by supporters after his reelection. Then, all smiles, he acknowledges well-wishers on a number of separate occasions.
The fact that McGovern lost, the fact that Nixon was re-elected again, and all that really upset us, because in the big picture, the United States, the policy of the United States would affect the whole world. And from that big picture, we were very depressed.
Once Nixon is re-elected, the FBI loses interest in Lennon, says, we're closing our file. The Immigration Service, though, is a good bureaucracy. They, when they're given a job, they do their job. And they kept doing their job. They kept doing it to Lenin for another year and a half, 2 years.
The situation is I'm still appealing. Like every now and then they'll say, you've got 30 days to get out, and then my lawyer will appeal, and we'll go up to another court or something like that, and it'll just go on forever. Terry Southern put it well. He says, it keeps the Conservatives happy that they're doing something about me or and what I represent. And it keeps the Liberals happy because I haven't actually been thrown out. So everybody's happy, you know?
The easy thing to do would have been just slink away and go back to England. But he chose to stand on his rights, and I'm glad that he did.
Lenin and his legal team went on the offensive and filed a couple of very interesting lawsuits.
I sued the Attorney General, Mitchell, and a whole slew of other people who I claimed were involved in a conspiracy to deny John and Yoko's case and get them out of the United States improperly.
What do you think your chances are of remaining in this country?
99 to 1.
For or against?
For.
Why is that?
Because I'm overconfident as usual.
We ultimately were able to examine the records in the case, and lo and behold, deep in John's immigration file, which was a high security file, were documents reaching all the way up to President Nixon, showing improper interference in an immigration case and prejudgment.
Probably the most important documents in the Lenin FBI file are reports addressed to the White House, signed by J. Edgar Hoover. Now, these were not sent directly to Richard Nixon. They're addressed to H.R. Haldeman, assistant to the president. Now, Haldeman was the most important person in the White House if you wanted to get to Nixon. So when Hoover sends something to Haldeman saying, here's our report on our progress in trying to kick Lenin out of the country, the reason that he's doing that is that Nixon wants to know.
I would not say that it was integral to the politics of the Nixon administration to keep John Lennon from having residence in this country. I think it was of a piece with the general nastiness of the Nixon administration.
Journalist Card Bernstein. A Washington Post headline reads, White House had agency spy on political rivals. August 15, 1973. President Nixon addresses the nation.
I had no prior knowledge of the Watergate break-in.
You had the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, who was running a rogue presidency, a criminal presidency.
We do know from Mr. Nixon's long statement of May the 22nd that he did approve much earlier a program of wiretapping and even burglary in national security matters.
Did other presidents break the law, bend the law occasionally? I'm sure they did. Was there wholesale criminality in any other presidency in our history? No.
For God's sakes, they committed a burglary and then they destroyed the government of the United States covering it up. That is the context in which you have to determine and judge and value what they did to John Lennon.
The case against John Lennon by the FBI and the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and by President Nixon and all his people, was that John Lennon was disloyal to the United States of America and what it stood for. The real disloyalty was Nixon's, Hoover's, the INS, and all the people who were implicated in the FBI and the INS and wherever else, because their perversion, distortion of the Constitution, their violation of the basic principles. So that was the greatest disloyalty to this country.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
News footage. Nixon grins as he crosses the White House lawn, boards a helicopter, and waves farewell.
Lenin was somebody who was a born enemy of those who govern the United States. He was everything they hated. So I just say that he represented life and is admirable. And Mr. Nixon and Mr. Bush represent death. And that is a bad thing.
Now, I have to tell you one little story about the end of the case. I got a call from someone in the Court of Appeals, and he said, look, the decision just came in. You won your Lennon case. And I called John, and he said, wait, what do you mean we won? You told us that it was a loser. I said, yes, because I didn't want to build up your hopes too much. And he said, Leon, I'm just going over to New York Hospital because Yoko is giving birth any minute. I'll call you from there. At about 5:30, I was bleary when he called. And he said, this is John. And I said, John who? And he said, John Lennon, and I have a beautiful boy. That day was his birthday, his new son's birthday, and he won his case.
I remember John's face. I remember how he was when we got that news, and when it was his birthday, and when he got the baby as well. And it was incredible. I've never seen him like that. He was like a little boy, looking so happy.
Hi.
Hi.
John Lennon was finally presented with his green alien card, which is actually blue, in the offices of the assistant director, and he talked to the press.
And this was what it was all about. Finally, after 4.5 long years of struggle, John Lennon got his card, a green card, saying that he's now a permanent resident of the United States.
Right on, brother.
To come out in court on the steps of the courthouse, of the federal courthouse, and there he is, and my goodness, he has defeated John Mitchell and the forces of evil, and he's going to be able to stay in the country.
And I take this opportunity to thank all the kids and the fans who wrote to all their senators and their petitions and all the rest of it that were working behind the scenes for 5 years with no pay or no nothing, actually. Just a smile.
Well, I say you bear any grudge against the Strom Thurmonds and the John Mitchells for putting you through this all these
years? No, I believe time wounds all heals.
John carries his son Sean in a sling as he walks with Yoko in Central Park, New York.
John was so proud of Sean, and there was such an incredible, warm and close relationship between them. And it was a beautiful time.
I see that you're having your diaper changed. Is this an enjoyable experience? Because I do believe some people pay to have this done. Exactly. And where did you get that outfit from, may I ask? I agree entirely, yes. It is exciting, isn't it?
Footage of John and Sean enjoying the rides at a fun fair.
John, Sean, and I started to have such a fantastically sweet and wonderful life together. There was that feeling of closeness between all three of us, and almost a kind of urgency about it, that every day we wanted to really spend together, kind of thing. And we did.
John and Sean wear party hats as they sit at a crowded table. Then together they blow out the candles on a birthday cake. Next, along with Yoko, they're waist deep in water, waving happily for the camera. The picture freezes. It gets darker. Darker. Black.
From Washington, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. The death of a man who sang and played the guitar overshadows the news from Poland, Iran, and Washington tonight. Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York. The alleged killer is an unemployed security guard and printer who had lived in Hawaii. News of Lennon's death touched off a wave of shock and mourning around the world.
A placard shows a photo of John, along with the message, Remember Love, John Lennon, 1980. Then distraught fans weep as they gather at a vigil.
I think the vigil was a very good thing that we did. It was all of us around the world came together in a way. So we made a ring around the world together. It was a very strong ring.
A large crowd of people, some of whom weep openly, others hold candles. A placard reads, "The whole world is sad. John Lennon, thanks for your music and genius."
Well, I suppose they tried to kill John. But they couldn't because his message is still alive.
Shots of large crowds, many of whom have their hands raised, making the V sign of peace. Photograph. Standing directly beneath the Statue of Liberty, John smiles, his right arm raised, his fingers making the peace sign. The end.
Where we are.